Mini episode 835 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to mini episode number 835 of the FDH Lounge. FDH managing partner Rick Morris here, along with two of my fellow FDH Lounge original dignitaries, our senior editor Jason Jones, my good friend Chris Galloway. It is traditional to get the three of us together after the NFL draft every year just to kind of break things down. A lot of times to do this before the draft as well, as we did with Chris leading into the draft this year. So, Chris, welcome back. You and I forecast that there was going to be a lot of weird stuff to look for in the draft this year, a lot of unpredictable stuff, and if nothing else, you and I were right about that, no question.
Thanks for having me back, Rick. And yes, it was certainly an action-packed first round and second round, a lot of wheeling and dealing up and down, teams moving all over the place for perceived, value, and then a lot of reaches. Probably at quarterback.
Yeah, there were. And that really kind of tends to be the story a lot of years with the draft. There's only a very limited supply of players at that position who can come in and provide big upgrades. But my grandfather, one of his old sayings, you know, about somebody's eyes being bigger than their belly, I think that a lot of times portrays the way the teams look at quarterback here. They just get a little bit greedy. They want to believe that somebody can be the quarterback. Unfortunately, I think my team was guilty of that as well. We'll get to that and more. Jason, good to get you in here, my man. I could tell from talking to you off air, there's going to be some interesting points of contrast with you and Chris, but what are your immediate thoughts coming out of the draft?
Well, in a selfish way, I've actually waited for this sort of a draft to happen for quite some time. I know conventional wisdom says take as many shots as you can, throw against the wall, see what sticks and what doesn't, cast aside. But every now and then, you know, the draft just unfolds in a way that makes you go, I know we got holes to fill, but can we just get a handful of killers and just move on with our lives?
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like you had a couple different teams, not just the one that is dearest to our hearts, but there were a couple teams out there that seemed to really go for the, you can call it a high-risk, high-reward type of situation, but coming out of that first round especially, or even the first 50, with some real names that everyone knows without question and feel they have a good read on how they'll be at the next level. And that's sometimes exciting as a little bit of a contrast.
It really is, and it was a year when we knew going in there were so many different scenarios that could kind of play out, and that really anything that you were looking at on paper for the most likely one, and any kind of chalk scenario was going to disintegrate very quickly, as we saw when we were going through this here. And as far as just a general overview of the draft, something that we do every year coming out of it is we apply two different metrics from FDH for this. One is based on your rankings, Jason, of the top available players. In this case, this year was a top 100 list, so applying a point system to that. And then there is another system that we do that matches up the top team needs along with players off of that. It's 50%, 50% essentially on team needs and value of players acquired. Now, on the one that simply measured the 50% of each, the needs and top prospects overall, Cleveland Browns coming out in first place on that system, 694 points. A wide gap over second place, Baltimore 600 going through the rest of the top five, Tennessee 563, Cincinnati 544, and a tie for fifth, San Francisco and Minnesota 525. The full list available at the FDH Lounge Multimedia Magazine at the fdhlounge.blogspot.com, as is the other list here. The Browns top that one as well, just based off the top 100 and point selection that accrues from that. The Browns, 698 points. New Orleans, second at 620. Jets, third at 478. Baltimore, fourth at 460. Washington, fifth at 432. So, Jason, I'll start with you because this is based off of your player rankings and as far as that part of it, how it goes and how we weight the assignment of points from that. I got a call from one of our fellow FDH Lounge dignitaries right after this was posted, our good friend Mike Petek, who said, are you guys saying that the Browns won the draft? They were first on both of those? And I said, Mike, I think reality is a little more complicated than that. I said, you know, looking back at last year, we scored the Browns the highest on the one that was the team needs and the top. Last year was a top 75. They scored out highest in that, and just looking at the top 75 last year, they scored second. And the draft to this point, I think we would agree, is kind of underwhelming. I look at this year's draft, and yes, I can say on paper all this stuff is relevant and true to whatever degree. I also look at it in terms of opportunities lost, something that Chris and I have talked about here, a guy like Malik Hooker. I'll always prefer a guy like him over Peppers just because free safety, strong safety. And Chris has pointed out strong safety is very important in the Greg Williams defense, and I agree with that to whatever degree. But you could have had Malik Hooker at 12. You didn't have to take Kaiser in the second round. I look at opportunity cost. I come in more like a B-. I think I'm probably going to end up being much more bearish than the two of you guys, Jason.
Well, first of all, if we can be completely objective about this, I think the difference between this year and last year might entertain the idea of reevaluating how everything is weighted.
Mm-hmm.
Because while I would agree that I think that this draft, especially from an impact perspective, will prove to be slightly better than last year's draft, if not significantly more so, if the contributions of Peppers and Njoku are what at least I think they will be. But I think that the root issue and why those two may seem like polar opposite drafts could be so close is that the Browns, since during the Sashi Hugh Jackson era, have really been conscious about making sure that they always have multiple picks. It seems like they are trading down to trade down sometimes and not
really
excited about drafting players. So if you go into every year and you have three picks in the top, 35? Then I think that the math's going to kick in and it's always going to look like they had a really good draft just based on that alone. So we may want to revisit that and see exactly how that plays out.
Good point.
Because I do think that this draft was better than last year, even though I think if you, depending on how far down the rabbit hole we go, I mean, Carl Nassib was a heck of a value pick, and I really love Ogba in the second. So there are pieces that I think are really, really good, and maybe we'll look back on this 5 years from now and say, you know, 2016, 17, and 18 ended up being like the Minnesota-Chicago, or Minnesota-Dallas trade with Herschel Walker that redefined a franchise. So who knows? But with that being said, I do think that maybe we want to take a look at that again.
Right.
But I also do think that this particular draft was incredible. I'm not going to disagree with the Malik Hooker thing. Only that, I don't know. If you're looking safety versus safety, sure, I don't know how you can't take Hooker over Jabril Peppers every single time and twice on Sunday. But there seems to be a little bit more of a plan in play, or at least that's what they're talking about so far, where maybe the overall total contributions to the team might be more for Peppers. So I don't know how it shakes out yet. The idea that we were staring down the barrel of Malik Hooker at 12 was great, and then trading all the way back to 25, I don't know about you guys, but I was having some sort of really bad deja vu,
right,
PTSD kind of reaction,
yep,
to the Alex Mack trade back. So take that for what it's worth.
No, I agree with that, and that's a thing where, you know, Chris, I know that you agree with me, at least in terms of the second round, the opportunity cost with taking Kaiser, a guy who's a real project there in that spot. Again, as I say, I expect that my analysis is more bearish than yours. But it's a thing also, too, in terms of what Jason just said there about always trading back. You know, Bobby Bethard eventually, by the end of his career, was basically laughed out of polite society for doing the thing of, like, I'll trade next year's number one pick for a number two this year. Tell me how the Browns aren't doing the exact opposite thing year after year, and yet we put that on a pedestal. It's always next year's draft, next year's draft. That's what it was all about at 12. I was devastated when they traded back. Again, I like the first-round haul overall, and a B-minus is by far, if I'm right about that, by far the best draft they've had in a long time, sadly enough. So I'm not really bashing when I say all of this, but tell me how you see it from your perspective, Chris.
Well, I would say first, Bethard is the classic boomer. He was mortgaging the future for today.
Yeah.
So it's actually the opposite. The Browns are constantly doing the opposite.
We're mortgaging today for the future.
On all their investments.
Right. We're mortgaging today for the future.
I get what you're saying about Hooker. Mm-hmm. I can get that. I had him rated better at the higher stage of prospect, but here's the deal about that. Not Hooker versus Peppers. It's would you rather have Hooker or Peppers and an additional number one next year? That's where their process and their analytics falls into play. So they've got a rating, they've got these guys on the board, and they say, okay, what do we want more? Do we want Hooker or do we want Peppers and a number one next year? And almost under every circumstance, as long as the drop off isn't that large between Hooker and Peppers, in terms of how you rated them, then every single time you're going to take that deal. Now, the thing about it is that is not short-term investing. That is a process that you set up and you execute year after year after year. This is not 2, 3, 4 years. This is 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years of replenishing the cupboard again and again with talented young players and having a lot of bites at the apple. That's the process that they're setting up. Now, the question, of course, is Jackson, will Haslam have the patience to see it through for, that length of time? If he does, I believe it will be transformative in how teams look to go about the draft, moving forward. You might end up in a situation in the future where, everyone will look to trade down and even have trade partners. Because if it ends up working for the Browns, others will start to copy it. You've got to look at it slightly different. And yes, I think it's going to skew your draft rankings the way you weight the players and how they came about. What I would tell you is that Browns draft in year one, although not loaded with obvious superstar type talent, I still believe that is a very. I think last year's draft, frankly, was a very New England Patriots type draft, where if you've already had a talented, quality team, you would have added a lot of really good players to supplement in terms of depth and prospects to develop over a 2 or 3 year cycle. Unfortunately for the Browns, they started this process, and that was year one of the rebuild. So people look at it and go, well, there's no obvious great players there. Well, I think that could change when you start to get great players in. Who's going to benefit the most from Garrett? It's going to be Ogba. He's going to be the biggest benefactor having Myles Garrett on the other side. Guys like Nassib are going to benefit because, if he continues to work at his game, he's going to have an increased role potentially in terms of depth. So I'm not prepared to write off last year's draft class as just one big disaster. I don't think it was, amazingly great, but I think it's going to provide some depth and some talent. This year's, I think, was far better in terms of what they did in terms of moving down. And when you talk about Kaiser, yes, it's a project, but at the end of the day, quarterback is a desperate need for the Browns, and you have to take a quarterback every year somewhere until you find the guy that can get the job.
Well, and again, I'm well on record as saying that I wanted Watson. I'm not going to beat a dead horse on that, but that's what I wanted them to do with the 12th pick when he was sitting right there. But I want to ask you first to follow up on that, Chris. Then I'll go to Jason on this to get his thoughts on it with Kaiser. Again, I know from Facebook his thoughts are different than mine on that issue there. I go back to a conversation that I had with FDH Lounge dignitary Joe Stazak on his then FM radio show in Philadelphia at the time. We were talking NFL draft last year. It was right about this time we were also actually talking NBA draft, and it was in that context we're talking about Ben Simmons. And I said, you know, they say this kid could be the next LeBron if he could only shoot better. And I said, that's kind of a tough skill to learn at the pro level. That's what I say about Kaiser and accuracy, Chris. This whole thing of like, oh my God, if he could just get his accuracy under control, how many guys could you say that about in the NFL? Derek Anderson, Brandon Whedon, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to sit here and say it can't happen, but neither am I going to sit here and say it's a high probability thing to happen.
Well, I agree. I think Kaiser's challenges in terms of accuracy are certainly the first and biggest red flag as it relates to his ability to prosper as starting quarterback in the NFL. I mean, I think that's the reason why people around the Browns are like, hey, give Cody Kessler a chance. Because, you know, for his flaws, you know, he is accurate. You know, and people about Kessler, they say, well, you know, arm strength is going to weaken up. Well, he's working on that. You know, Tom Brady didn't have a big arm when he came to the NFL. So that's something you can work on. Accuracy, you can. Some of that accuracy, though, for Kaiser, I think was a result of the, you know, the lack of playmakers with Notre Dame last year, piss poor coaching, and the all-around malaise of that program, which to me sets up the next red flag as it relates to Kaiser, which is how much of a student of the game is he going to be? What's his attitude going to be? You know, I've heard some plenty of people say he's a smart guy, but you know. Is he going to put in the time? Is he going to be too me-oriented? We've heard those criticisms, you know, lack of leadership, me-oriented. Those are the things that I worry about. As you know, I tend to stress intelligence and maturity and leadership in terms of quarterbacks, and that's the thing that worries me greatly about Kaiser.
That's a great point. I will say on that, though, that Hugh Jackson was impressed that there was something that he had said to him about footwork that he had incorporated in before his pro day. So he'd already picked that up and used it and gone with it. And we can only hope, as Browns fans, that is a sign of things to come as far as his receptiveness to coaching. Jason, as I said previously, I know that your take on Kaiser is a little sunnier, perhaps, than mine and Chris's.
Okay. We need to accurately... make my point on this. We kind of have to go all the way back. Now, not all of this is going to be ironclad concrete facts, so take with a grain of salt just how much you believe that what I'm about to say is accurate. Hugh Jackson was the pick from the beginning, and Hugh Jackson was told, as I understand it, from ownership as part of their coming together, that he would not have your typical 2, maybe 3-year window, and that Haslam was willing to give him upwards of 5 years before actually getting concerned about where they are in the grand scheme of things. So that tells me that Hugh Jackson's got a bit of a leash that most previous coaches, at least at that franchise, have not had. Combined that with the fact that he's somewhat a offensive guru, quarterback whisperer, whatever you want to call him, we are sort of inflating the legend of Hugh Jackson, but, you know, take it for what it is. But we get into this draft. I didn't need it to be a top 2 quarterback. And Rick, you and I, for quite some time, I want to say a year and a half at least, we're both kind of saying the prize is Watson. And for almost 2 years, the prize is Watson. That's the quarterback you want. The franchise guy, that's who you go get. And I would have taken him number 1 overall last year. I don't want to say I'm soured on him, but my enthusiasm has gone down a little bit. But that's still saying that he's, you know, probably one of the top 3 prospects in the last few years. So I'm not saying that Watson's not great. I think he's going to be really, really solid. But again, this kind of goes back to Chris's point about looking at the bigger puzzle. And to me, I would rather have Garrett, Peppers, Kaiser, and Njoku, however it falls, than I would rather have Garrett and Watson. So that's really where my enthusiasm comes. And the bottom line for me was with the Canton quarterback in this draft or last draft, all I wanted was to know that, for lack of a better term, you had played a mold. So there's a part of me that's very excited about 6'4", 220-plus with a cannon for an arm that, you know, may need some side adjustment. But I love the idea that this supposed quarterback grooming genius finally has somebody to groom. Now, that being said, unless he goes in there and he is just flat out in every single way better than Kessler and Brock or whoever else they want to bring in, and this is not normally my take, I don't think Kizer should see the field at all in 2017. Because, as you guys mentioned, there are accuracy concerns. I'm not as down on the guy for the leadership thing. And maybe that's just because I'm watching too much video on the Browns website, but who knows. But I just love the fact he's got a guy to groom. And if it takes 2 years, then so be it. But again, it all comes back to how much faith you put in the idea that Jimmy and his wife are giving this current regime to have a legitimate rebuild.
I gotta say, the biggest current state of my despair would be as far as looking ahead to next year's draft. I've had some people say to me, "Ah, well, no big deal if it doesn't work out. Just go get Sam Darnold." I guarantee you, the Jets and the 49ers, as badly as they're tanking next year, they're probably going to be 1-2 in the draft, and you won't be able to pry Sam Darnold away from the cold, dead fingers of whoever's number one, I gotta believe. So, ain't no trading up for that. You gotta hope that some of the other guys, the kid from either UCLA or Wyoming or somebody else like that, proves to be a high enough first-round value, if indeed the Browns are looking quarterback again next year, as I suspect they might, but we'll see how this goes. As far as the overall draft itself, Chris, we were talking about this coming in, and you were talking about the overall depth of the thing. I think this is where you're going to diverge from Jason a little bit. I got to say, I'm more on your side of the coin here as far as where I feel like there was depth throughout the draft here, the chance to keep accruing value into the mid rounds, and sometimes even the later rounds more so than usual. And again, a star-studded first night as it generally is, but there were great values on day two. Dalvin Cook with where he slipped to, he never should have gone as far down as he did. Ending up with the Vikings, but you had some players that really even into day three were great values, including, I got to say, to my great frustration, Chad Kelly going to Denver. I am not nearly the Chad Kelly honk that FDH Lounge dignitary Anthony Patron is, but in the seventh round, my God, how do you pass on him there? But indicative, I think, of the kind of value that there was to be had through all 3 days of the draft, Chris.
I think if you're Denver, how do you not just take a flyer on Chad Kelly in the last pick of the draft?
Right.
Why not just lock him up so you bring him in the camp? You don't have to try to find him because now you got the free agent.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say this. I think this was the most talented draft we've had in a while in terms of depth overall. I think there's going to be a lot of Pro Bowl and All-Pro quality players out of this draft, more so than the average, and certainly more so than last year. That said, I will agree with Jason on a certain point, which is, I felt that once we got to round six and seven, there was a real drop-off of the cliff in terms of guys that I'd want to bother drafting, which is kind of why I understand the Browns, roll the dice on a guy like Brantley out of Florida, because if things clear up for him legally, it could end up, you could get a third-round talent in the sixth round. They don't, whatever, it was some, throwaway guy you were going to draft anyway. I do think, though, that 1 through 5, those rounds, I thought had more depth than we've seen in recent history. And I thought there were a lot of teams that really took advantage of that depth in their draft strategy. So I'm not as down on that depth as Jason is. I thought it was pretty solid this year. And to that end, I wasn't surprised the way the top of the draft went, where because we were so... The perception was that this was a lot more talent and depth on the defensive side. people before the draft kept talking about, oh, well, you know, there's going to be all these defensive guys going to be running off the board because there's so much talent. And, of course, I kept thinking to myself, well, if that's the case, that means at the top of the draft we're going to see a run on offensive players, because if you've got enough depth on defense, you're going to grab the handful of the best of the best on the offense first, and then wait and, you know, and fill in on the defensive later, if it's exactly what we saw. So, you know, I would let Jason refer to why he thinks it's a weak draft. I certainly disagree.
Hey, before we do, quick follow-up with you, Chris, with what you said about Brantley there, because I go back to day three of the draft there, and I had tweeted no more than an hour beforehand. I was getting in a good little gloat on the Bengals with them taking Joe Dixon. You know, they're the only team out there where you rise on their draft board for being a criminal. This is probably the only draft show anywhere in America that's going to quote Kurt Vonnegut, but I'm looking at it like nothing was lost save honor. I mean, what is the difference philosophically between the Browns and the Bengals, other than the fact that the Bengals have done it repeatedly? For the Browns, if you're just looking at it purely through the green eye shades kind of thing, OMG value, well, the Browns scored, that was one of the reasons they scored higher on our point system this year, is yes, by getting a more talented guy in the mid to later rounds, but what's the trade-off in terms of what you're putting out there as far as what your organization is all about?
I really do, but I think at the same time, they looked at it like this sort of situation. You know, from a public relations standpoint, he's a late round draft pick. He's not going to have the high profile element that Mixon is. You're drafting Mixon, you're bringing him into camp, you're signing into a 5-year deal, and you're telling your community, hey, this guy is part of our future. We're going to sell jerseys in our store with his name on it, and we expect you guys to cheer for him every time he touches the ball. The Browns, on the other hand, expended a 6th-round pick on a guy that they would acknowledge has a sudden illegal problem, and we don't know what the reality of that is yet. You know, somebody claims that he punched the woman in the face. Others were saying that, you know, he didn't. So if you're the Browns, you're using a 6th-round pick, and I get the whole morality question, but just stepping out of that, as we know, teams don't play the morality game; they play the PR game, and so. For the Browns, it was, hey, 6th-round pick. We go, you know, 2-3 months down the road before we get to camp, and this guy's, you know, found guilty of having slugged a woman in the face. We cut him loose. We lose the rights. He never comes to camp. It's not a story moving forward. We don't have to own it. And we're not going to be out there promoting him as a high draft pick, expecting, you know, to carry the ball and score a lot of touchdowns for us. So in that regard, you know, the Browns, you know, I think there's a lot less PR difficulty. You know, to that end, you can say, hey, you could, you know, the way you sort of told the Bengals the way you did, you know, I've always said and maintained, well, how are the Browns any different? I mean, we run Jim Brown out there, known woman beater,
right?
And celebrate him and cheer for him, and he gets to call picks and show up at the draft, and the commissioner applauds him. And so, you know, if you want to talk morality, there's not a lot of daylight between the Browns and the Bengals. At the end of the day, it comes back to public relations and what you're willing to, you know, to take on in terms of baggage. Brantley presents them with an opportunity for great potential and upside with very little baggage, because if he makes the team and he's on the team at camp, it means he was cleared of the most egregious of what he's accused of.
Yeah, and those are good points, sadly, about Jim Brown, but that's right. And I remember Botch Davis taking Jeremiah Farms some years ago. So, yeah, it's not like the Browns haven't done this either. And as far as what you said about PR, that's why Sashi Brown, I think, broke the team's 40-yard dash record getting to the spin room to talk to the media as soon as they made the pick. I think that would account for that. Jason, take it wherever you want to go. If you want to start with the Brantley thing, if you got any comments about that. But beyond that, to where you would disagree with Chris about the draft and the depth of the draft this year.
Well, let me hit Brantley real quick. I think everything when it comes to a player that may or may not be facing trouble or may or may not be coming out of facing trouble is all in how you present it. Now, I heard for a month out here, you know, the Denver fan base out here really divided on the idea that they need a running back because C.J. Anderson's not going to cut it. And they were hoping Christian McCaffrey, because that would have just been a marriage made in soap opera heaven. But looking at Joe Mixon was something that I was hearing a lot about, and the overwhelming consensus seemed to be you can't let him be the face of your draft class. So
right.
There were a large portion of people that were saying, well, if somebody trades up into the first round, maybe a team that didn't have a first-round pick, and then they'll get Mixon, and he's the guy you march out there, then we got a bit of a PR nightmare. Whereas what we saw with Cincinnati, let's pick somebody who's not got those issues, and then we'll just fly him in under the radar, as we found out didn't exactly work so well. Now, in addition to that, when we look at Caleb Brantley, depending on whether you're looking at my board, your board, the Browns board, I don't know anybody that had him talent-wise available after the third round. I probably would have put him in the top 50-ish. I really do think that talent-wise, that's where he fits. Now, having this big wrinkle over his head is a whole different issue, but to my point, unless it was, you know, if it was Sashi just taking advantage of the opportunity or backtracking as fast as possible or what, the idea that Brantley was going to be taken and will hold our breath, and if he's cleared, great. If he's not, we'll let him go. I think at least that says to the community in question that if he turns out to be the POS that the media wants to believe that he is, well, he's not for us, he's not going to be our team. But if we find out that through due course that maybe he's not that, then we've got ourselves a heck of a steal. And I'm okay with it. So if Brantley ends up shooting up in training camp, and he did so because he was never charged or whatever the issue is, I'll be okay with it. I'm a little less eager to forgive a guy that I've seen video footage of punch a woman in the face.
Right.
But then again, I don't actually know the details of the Brantley case. So, if he's cleared, great, I'll take it, and I'll count it as maybe the steal of the draft. And if he's not cleared, then he can go find employment elsewhere. Now, as far as the idea of the value of the draft, it's been my experience that normally you get to about the fifth round, and then you start looking around and going, there are still players out there that I like. And a great example of that is if we go back to that I'm drawing a blank. The bad guy that played Arizona State that got picked up by Cincinnati after the draft.
Perfect.
Yeah, in that particular draft, we were going into the seventh round going, oh my goodness, there's still like 12 to 15 guys out there that might actually project to being starters. What is going on? And this year I looked at it and, you know, I'll be honest, this is line of demarcation probably works. It was more or less the end of the fifth round.
Okay.
Where you kind of went, okay, there's about two or three guys I still like. Just two or three guys I would move around to get. But unlike most years, when you got to the sixth and seventh round, you're like, man, who are these people? And even when I was setting up some of these rankings before the draft started, you know, we get ambitious and want to do, you know, a top 200 or top 300. I just couldn't put my name next to it because there are so many players out there that, yes, have potential or, yes, have a skill set that translates, but there's always something that made me kind of go, I just can't put them there. So my issue is not to say that, and this might be me backtracking, but I'm not saying that it is a poor value draft. I just think that In a NFL draft scenario where we are used to still seeing quality players on the board going into the seventh round, I thought it was slim pickings. Now, if we're talking about rounds 1 through 5, whole different ballgame. Because there's some real talent there, and I agree with Chris that there's starters and Pro Bowlers throughout, and I would not be surprised at all. And, you know, you can bring up a name like a Caleb Brantley, but I would not be surprised at all if a few years from now we're seeing serious, consistent starters or contributors that were taken in the fourth or fifth round of this draft.
Well, it's funny because that just goes to show you when you're talking to somebody off air and you just sort of get like a soundbite level here. It sounded like you guys were at odds on your opinion of it, and you come out in about the same place, as you both explain in a little bit more depth where you're coming from here. What I'd like to do also with you guys here in the course of this is to get a sense of general winners and losers as we're going through. I mean, I would put the Browns somewhere on the list of winners, if only because, again, B minus if I'm right, and that's a lot more bearish than a lot of people are. B minus is like the greatest draft of all time compared to where they've been coming from with the baseline with this franchise. So they would certainly be on there. I would put the 49ers on there. John Lynch looks like a polished pro. Then again, when you're taking advantage of those schlemiels in the Chicago Bears front office, maybe it's not so hard. But somehow or another got them thinking that they might trade the pick to somebody else or take Trubisky themselves when it was never going to be the case. The 49ers get two excellent defensive players in the first round and still keep themselves positioned in the Sam Darnold sweepstakes for next year. So I liked what they did very much. Just going through here, didn't like what the Chiefs did with trading up for Mahomes. Thought that was a very, very bad move on their part. When you're looking at teams that were just, you know, sweeping up and kind of taking advantage of value, what the Redskins did with Jonathan Allen, what the Colts did with Malik Hooker, Tampa Bay with O.J. Howard, I think there was a strong case to be made going for Dalvin Cook there, but my God, the passing weapons they're going to have going into next year. So there were some teams I thought that really came out of it fairly strong. Like I said, Kansas City, in my estimation, not so much. The Bears, not so much. Common denominator there. Being teams that went for quarterbacks where I thought it was a bad move on their part. Jacksonville with Leonard Fournette I thought was a pretty good thing here. They had a lot of needs to be sure, but again, if he's the next AP, then there's something to be said for that. By the way, when we're talking about value too, Lattimore going to New Orleans at 11, that was a great value pick as well. Lattimore and Hooker were both top five on a lot of mock drafts, my own included, so there were a lot of teams I thought that did well and did poorly, as is the case every year. So, Chris, the ones that stand out on either extreme to you, how do you see it?
The Browns with an A-minus overall. I thought that they did a really nice job, and then they came away and they came away from this draft. Again, plugging in the analytics, they came away with five of the five picks in the first two rounds now next year. I mean, that's if your talent evaluators do it right, that's how you build a quality team. Some teams I liked. I liked the Cardinals. I liked Reddick and Buda Baker shoring up their defense. I like the O-line depth that they drafted late. I love T.J. Logan out of North Carolina. I think he's another one of these guys. He's a running back, and one of these guys that's going to jump on the scene. People are going to say, why didn't his coaches use him more in college, and why didn't they use him better? You know, more a problem with Trubisky. I also love what the Cowboys did. I mean, they got defensive end. They picked up a bunch of secondary help to go with their losses and their weaknesses there. And then again, Ryan Switzer, who is a, an Amendola Edelman-type slot receiver, who will provide great depth. Probably not this year for the Cowboys, but the following year. I love what the Colts did, picking up Hooker at safety, Quincy Wilson at cornerback, desperate needs, solidifying the back end of their defense. And they went and picked, here's my OU plug just for Jason, Terrell Basham, defensive end, Ohio.
Yes.
And you know, Terrell's a guy that's not going to be ready to go in year one. He's going to be, year three, they're going to look at him and say, where'd that guy come from? He's a bit of a, I still think, a development player, even though he went the third round. But he has all the physical tools, and I loved what Tampa Bay did in terms of adding talent to their roster that gives that young team some playmakers. Teams I didn't like the Giants overall, what they did.
Right.
I was not a fan of the Jets after round 1 and 2. I loved the two safety picks.
Yes.
Ted Adams is the best player in this draft. So the Jets getting him automatically, get an A for the first round, and then after that, picking up an A in the second round, okay, perfect safety, got it squared away, you're good to go. What else are you going to do? You're going to address needs. And then, I didn't see that the rest of the draft. So it was like, started off great, and then it was like, okay, now is this when the tanking comes in? And then, got a probably the first round talent, potential Pro Bowler, who, we don't know what his legal situation is still.
Right.
Because it certainly seems that initially now he said that he never, he never had any sexual contact with a woman, and now it's like, well, yeah, he did. So I don't know that you can believe his situation. Don't be stunned if he's not on that roster because he's heading to prison. And if that ends up being the case, what a complete waste of a young man's life, but also shame on you, Oakland, for wasting a first-round pick and on a guy that had a question mark next to his name. So that's one that I think could really blow up in their face. So that's kind of how I took the draft.
Well, and they're a team that, again, they have a lot of defensive needs, but they get them shored up, and in a very shallow AFC, they're a legitimate Super Bowl contender. So you cannot afford to blow that pick right there. I completely agree with you, and that is going to be very consequential for them if that turns out to be a blown pick and he is not able to contribute, because they're clearly counting on him being able to step in and, if not be a shutdown guy early on, at least growing into that role early on. Jason, how did you see this shaping up with some of the winners and losers?
Well, again, starting to look at the top spot there, as being what it is, I actually look at the Browns draft this time, and I see five significant contributors, if not lock-in starters, in year one. And for a team that has holes to fill, I don't think you can criticize that. So, and none of those are Deshaun Kizer, by the way. Anywho, I'll put him up in that A-minus, B-plus rank, and probably top three teams in the draft as far as what they were able to pull off. I got to just jump in on the Chiefs thing. Good grief. Now, Rick, everyone involved in what we're doing right now should be able to get on board with this idea. You don't move up and shed draft capital to pick a guy in the top 10 that you might have been able to get right where you were standing. Now, we all know there was going to be a runner quarterback, and there was. And they were not going to get him at 27. But they gave up a lot to get a guy that most people felt pretty firmly was in that third or fourth best quarterback spot.
Yep.
Now, since then, there's been a lot of people coming out of the woodwork saying that, oh, no, and Hugh Jackson's one of them, that we love Mahomes and think he may end up eventually being the best quarterback in this draft class. That's fine. But, we operate the rules of the real world, and value is paramount, and, if you had to trade up twice, fine, but, I think the Mahomes thing was crazy. I think Chicago was probably the worst possibility overall, not even just the Trubisky trade. I also really did not like Detroit. I felt like they kind of got these sloppy seconds at every turn. And then this is going to sound a little strange coming from me. I thought Denver crapped the bed, if I can say that.
Yeah.
Look, Bowles may turn out to be the best tackle option in this draft, but who cares if he's the 51st best left tackle in the NFL? So I thought that they kind of missed in a number of different places. Coming back around to the positive side, I like what Cleveland did. I thought Sean Lynch just walked in with swagger like a vet, as you mentioned. Because even he said after the fact, was just like, we never thought they'd take it. But they did, so hey, you're the bell of the ball right now, because they came out of the first round with arguably two players that almost every team, talent-wise, had in the top 10 of this draft. And they got them without picking two picks in the top 10 of the draft. And then everybody else just kind of fills in the middle. Outside of maybe three or four at the top and three or four at the bottom, the middle of the bell curve is very big. So I don't think anybody other than Chicago really did themselves a disservice. I think think everybody got better in some way. I just think that you've got teams like the Clevelands and San Franciscos of this draft that just did far and away better than most everybody else did. And I'll jump in and echo the sentiment on Dallas. Although Dallas did pretty solid without doing anything that was Ezekiel Elliott big, if that makes sense.
That does make sense. And
Dallas,
yep.
Dallas didn't do anything that was Jerry Jones stupid. So that was the nice part.
There you go.
Right. Well, and what I thought, Chris.
Rick, I have a question for Jason. He's out in Denver country.
Yeah.
What is the feeling about Elway last draft and this draft when it comes? I mean, Paxton Lynch is certainly looking like that's probably going to be a whiff. If the tackle this time doesn't work out, be you know, a 10-year All-Pro on the corner there. I mean, that's a couple bad whiffs at the top of the draft 2 years in a row.
There's a growing sentiment that when John Elway is picking especially defensive front seven players in the first round, that there's nothing that they have to worry about. When he starts picking for need, though, you might want to start boarding up the doors, waiting for the apocalypse, because there's a lot of people that have shed that idea that John Elway can do no wrong, which was the case starting with year one after Von Miller and so on. The weird thing is, just like any other team out there that feels that quarterback is the one thing left, you have Trevor Siemian people and you have Paxton Lynch people. So far, Paxton Lynch has got to get his head in the books, because just listening to him speak, you can tell it's almost like he's not mentally ready to take the reins yet. And Trevor Siemian is the opposite end of that spectrum. He wants it. He wants it more in his hand. He's willing to work to get better. So I'm not ready to say whiff just yet, because it's a John Elway pick. You know John Elway's going to want him to play. Question is, will he? And if he does, what does that mean for Siemian? And in the end, will that have been the best decision? I know why they liked Paxton Lynch coming out, but if you recall, I was saying he was a top of the second round kind of guy, so I don't know where that shakes out, but the notion that John Elway can do no wrong and he is the man with the golden ticket is slowly but surely starting to fade a little bit.
That makes a lot of sense. By the way, what you guys were saying about Dallas, I thought that certainly, Chris, they repaired some of the damage done in free agency defensively. They got picked over pretty good, felt like they were able to, if not completely make up for it, take some steps in that direction.
Well, don't forget, they're getting back, who's the kid from Notre Dame, the linebacker?
Oh, Jalen Smith.
Yeah.
If that works out, that might be a stroke of genius.
I mean, if that works out, that's the second rounder last year that they were willing to sit on and hope that his nerve damage was not as long-term as some feared. And he is going to be in rookie camp this week, from what I understand. So he's coming back.
Well, a real clip and save right there to look at is the Cowboys essentially utilizing a redshirt pick in last year's draft. We'll see if he materializes this year and is able to do much of anything. And, of course, every year going through on the draft, I always brag about the FDH Lounge draft coverage, and this is why. I humbly challenge anyone to find conversation like this anywhere else on the Fruited Plain. A pleasure, as always. Chris, great to be able to bookend the draft with you this year, before and after. Thank you so much, as always, my man.
Thank you, sir. Always a pleasure.
Jason, our cleanup hitter at FDH for our NFL draft coverage, the guy who sets the rankings and really the baseline for all of our coverage. Thanks for coming out and breaking it down for us.
Oh, no problem. Always a pleasure to talk draft. Now comes the sad part where we have to wait another 6 months before starting to look at another draft. But hopefully it all pans out for whoever you're rooting for.
Yeah. Well, I'm already looking at mock drafts for next year, trying to conjure a case where the Browns could trade up to number one to get Sam Darnold, and I'm not nearly at that point yet. Hopefully I can conjure something here that I can believe in at some point, but we shall see. A true pleasure, as always. Thank you guys for being a part of this today, and thank you, everybody, for joining us for this mini episode of the FDH Lounge.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.